Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Margot True, the food editor of Sunset Magazine and your moderator for tonight's program. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Ellie Krieger. Ellie is the host of the Food Network show Healthy Appetite, which aired for 5 seasons and still runs on the network's website. She's also written 6 cookbooks, 2 of which were New York Times bestsellers, and has won cookbook awards from both the James Beard Foundation and the International Association of Culinary Professionals. Her knowledgeable, balanced approach to nutrition, combined with her warmth and charm, have made Ellie a sought-after guest expert on dozens of national television programs, including The Today Show, Good Morning America, CNN, and Dr. Oz. She writes a weekly column called Nourish for The Washington Post, and has written columns for many other publications too, including USA Today, Food Network Magazine, and Fine Cooking Magazine. And as someone who cares deeply about the health of all Americans, she's teamed up with hunger organizations such as Feeding America, Share Our Strength, and City Harvest, has testified before the House Committee on Agriculture about the epidemic of childhood obesity, and she's been part of First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign since day one. Please join me in welcoming Ellie Krieger to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. Thank you for such a nice introduction, Margo, and the warm welcome, everybody. Mm-hmm. It feels a little bit like San Francisco is kind of a second home for me because I do have so many friends here. Mm. Wonderful to be here.
Oh, we're glad you're here. So your new book is all about make-ahead cooking, and it's called, quite brilliantly, You Have It Made. I was thinking that's because part of what this book promises to its readers is that they'll, quote, as you say in the introduction, find the sweet spot where delicious and healthy meet. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that philosophy, because it seems to be a credo for you, a mantra over the years.
Yes, it very much is, and it's great that, and I'm not surprised that you homed in on that at all. Actually, I know we're going to get to this, but it's also the tagline for my upcoming public television show. So you yes. really did hit the nail on the head with, it's so central to what I do. So I feel that we live in a world where delicious is over here, and it's sort of presented that way, and healthy is over here. These two mutually exclusive circles, and it gets sort of worse in a way, because delicious is somehow something that the thing you really want, you know, the thing you're really craving, that you save up for, that that you're passionate about, but that somehow is bad for you, and that you should feel bad about, that you're not being good, right? We use these kinds of words a lot with food, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And then over here is healthy, where this is the food, you know, you should be eating, and that's clean, and that you're being good and all. And somehow, though, it's less desirable. It's not what you really, really want when it comes down to it. But the truth is that neither one of these extremes are the reality. And it's just sort of the way we set our mindsets. And the media really plays into this very much. But actually, they're two circles that have this beautiful meeting place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you want to live, where you have both food that is delicious and healthy, and that's what the sweet spot is. And that's what I'm always trying to find, personally and professionally.
And clearly, it's such a rich place to be, because you have tapped this for 5 books before this, each one of them different, you know, with their own focus, their own angle. What prompted you to write this particular book?
So my goal is to really help people find solutions to their everyday challenges of eating well. And there are lots of them. I mean, we're all juggling a lot, and myself included. And to be totally honest, I think sometimes I write books that I need, you know, in my busy life, because I have a 13-year-old daughter and a husband, and I want to have family meals as much as possible. I want it to be homemade food that hits that sweet spot where delicious and healthy meat. And I come home, and it's 6 o'clock, and I'm tired, and now what? And I live in New York City, and I could dial seven digits and essentially have anything delivered to me. But I like my food. I like homemade food. And it's never quite the same when you're ordering in. The fact is, it's certainly less healthy. You know, when you really do run the numbers on it, it's less healthful. The portions are bigger. And I think in many ways less satisfying. So You Have It Made was born of that. And my book before You Have It Made was Weeknight Wonders, which was 30-minute meals. So that's like you come home and you have 30 minutes. What are you going to put on the table? And so this one was sort of taking the same issue and tackling it from the other side. What can you make ahead? What can you have already done that you can pull out of the freezer? And I really try to make it as, you know, as much of an answer to issues that people are facing, because one of the things I did in the book was each recipe, I tried to give you solutions for really freezing it in individual portions, because families are running in all different directions. My daughter comes home from school, what's she gonna have as a snack? She can pull these little mini mac and cheeses out of the freezer that have, you know, that are made, that have butternut squash in them actually, as well as, lots of other good stuff, but, or like these harvest breakfast cookies, that's her favorite like after school snack, and as well as sometimes for breakfast. But just the idea that families can work around their schedules. Yes, it's important to all eat together, but a lot of times we're all just running in different directions, and I think this is a great solution for that. Or like I'm away all week, and there's lots of great food in the freezer that my husband can, you know, heat
turn
up.
Your freezer into an asset instead of where food goes to die. So often, isn't that the
case?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to think of your freezer as this generous gift to yourself.
It's so true. You
know, and to your family. It's wonderful. Well, I have to say, I've made several recipes from the book already.
I'm honored.
And I loved them. I really, really did. And I'm a kind of person who, you know, kind of learned to cook with the olive oil bottle upside down for about a minute, you know, into the pan. And I'd read your recipes and I think, how is this going to taste good if there's only a tablespoon of olive oil? And, you know, they do. They're fantastic.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And there are all these little surprises in each one, too. I made the cauliflower tabbouleh where, you know, you're not bringing in couscous or feta cheese, but you're grating a whole head of cauliflower. And it gives such an interesting dimension to the tabbouleh, and you can just eat piles of it, and you want to because it tastes good.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. And I'm not afraid of using olive oil. I mean, I feel like you should use it if you need it, but I think sometimes we just do it gratuitously. When you're sauteing an onion, you don't need that much. A tablespoon is fine. Mm-hmm. And then if you need some at the end to finish it, to balance the acid or whatever it is, by all means, it's healthful. But why add it if it's not really serving you?
Sometimes it's just habit.
Right. You know. And so many things are like that.
And I made the overnight blueberry oats, in which you're mixing oatmeal with milk and yogurt and pecans and blueberries and chia seeds. And in the morning, you have this creamy, delicious, I mean, it's delicious.
It kind of tastes like a pudding. And I think that's one of the cases also where I use a blueberry jam. I try to use minimal amounts of added sugar. And so it does need some sweetener, but I use blueberry, like all fruit jam instead of white sugar in it. Right. And I love how it comes out like a pudding, and I put it in these jars. So I do several recipes in the book in mason jars so that you have something you could just grab and bring to work or whatever. But literally my daughter insists that I make that for her every single week. That's her absolute favorite breakfast.
And it's great because you can use raspberries or other nuts or, you know, just
I have a pumpkin spice version of that in the book as well.
I saw that.
So that's
that
a fun one.
Might be next. And you bake oats too. There was one recipe that looked as though it was going to taste exactly like apple pie. You know,
it kind of does.
Really,
it's baked
enticing.
Oats, and it's a oatmeal bake essentially. So it's oatmeal and eggs and apples and nuts and a little maple syrup, and it's all baked together. So then at first, when you could just scoop it out, and it's almost like a bread pudding type of texture with lots of apples in it. So it has a cake kind of feel to it and has a crumbly topping. But then when you put it in the refrigerator, it literally, you could have this as breakfast all week. And I think, many of the recipes in the book are make ahead and freeze, and many are make ahead and you can have them in the fridge for 4 days. There's also many salads, which most people think, oh, salads, you can't make that ahead. But I find like really hearty salads that stand up.
Like the tabbouleh,
exactly. Yeah. And those are the kinds of things that are also great for bringing to barbecues that you know they're going to stand up as a like a potluck kind of thing, or putting out in a buffet or something like that, or bringing to lunch for work. So just having these solutions, I think, is really important.
Very helpful. And, you know, you're speaking of sugar and these sort of kind of sweetly appealing recipes. You don't list sugar in the nutrient information in the book. And you were telling me before we came out here why that is, and I found that interesting, and
yeah.
I wondered if you could.
Yeah, so I give all the nutritional information for all the recipes, and I'm not a numbers-driven person, and I think this is actually an important thing to bring up here. So when I develop my recipes, I develop them according to my philosophy about food, which really goes hand-in-hand with the sweet spot, which is looking at food as usually, sometimes, and rarely. And so the usually foods are the backbone of the recipe, the backbone of a person's diet. And that's whole, you know, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, beans, all those wonderful plant foods, whole grains, lean protein, fish, healthy oils, low-fat dairy. And then sometimes foods may be a little bit more processed, like French bread. You know, I'm not living my life without a piece of French bread. It's just ridiculous. Sourdough bread. Thank you. Why would you? And you don't have to. But, you know, that's not going to be your usually choice. But once in a while, it's totally fine. Things like that, or added sweeteners like honey that may be less refined, but you still want to use kind of sparingly. Then the rarelys are like bacon and cream and full fat cheese and sugar, white sugar. And that you can work it in, you know, and I say use that in minimal amounts for maximum impact. So that there's no such thing as never, which for me, the minute I hear the word never, I want that thing more than anything. And suddenly it gains this incredible importance when it's not very important, right? It becomes like this holy grail kind of thing. So you eliminate the word never, you look at the food like this. And so when I create my recipes, I don't do it to get to a certain nutritional profile. I literally create my recipes with usually, sometimes, rarely. The backbone of it is vegetables and grains and beans and health and lean proteins. And then I'll sprinkle in a little bit of sweetener if it needs it. I'll try to go for the less refined. I'll put some real cheddar cheese or blue cheese or whatever in there and put it on top and use a real strong flavored cheese so that it really works. And then what's remarkable is I always do the nutrition analysis and provide that as well, because it helps guide decision making. You know, if you're trying to understand food a little bit better on different levels. But the numbers work out, which I find really cool, that when you cook this way and you think this way and you eat this way, the numbers take care of themselves. So I do those numbers, but I don't add sugar, to come back to your question. I don't put the sugars in, because in the nutritional analysis and on the food label currently that we have, all the sugars are lumped together. So it's not only added sugars that are on that line item, it's also sugars that are naturally occurring in foods like fruit and milk, for example. And while your body does recognize all sugars the same in pure form, when you eat sugars inherent in fruits, for example, they're a package deal. You're getting them with fiber. You're getting them with a lot of water. You're getting them with a lot of nutrients. So it's very important, I think, not to lump all sugars together. And actually, it's one of the, and it's not, doesn't inform really you at all. If you're looking at your blood sugar, you want to look at total carbohydrate anyway. So if you have diabetes and you're concerned about a rise in blood sugar, the number of sugars matters, is basically irrelevant compared to the total carbohydrate in the recipe. So there's really no plus, in my opinion, to looking at total sugar. And I'm really hoping that in the revised label ruling, which is coming out soon, I think, it is recommended, the recommendation now is that the change will include a line for added sugars. Yeah. I think the industry's not too happy about that.
Probably not, the soda makers for sure. Well, and your food is also, I noticed this as I cooked these recipes, the halibut with a sauce made out of whole carrots that you puree with ginger and sesame oil, and it's wonderful. All of your food is very colorful, and I wondered if you create recipes with that in mind too, or does it just sort of work out that way? Is it intentional?
Oh, that's interesting. I think we do eat with our eyes, so I'm always thinking of how something's going to look. And also, I'm cooking things for television and taking pictures of it, so I definitely factor that in when I'm thinking about a recipe. But automatically, if you cook with lots of vegetables, you're getting a lot of color. And I love that halibut recipe because I try to think a little out of the box in terms of how to approach things, but without it being difficult. So truth be told, I'm a little bit, maybe not lazy cook, but I don't like fussing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take forever to make something. I don't want a big project. Every once in a while, I'll do a big project, but maybe several times a year. Day-to-day cooking is what I really am trying to help people transform their lives literally by cooking. And if you cook more, it's amazing the effect that that has. You automatically eat healthier foods. You automatically have a higher nutrient content. You automatically eat more normal portions. You're not going to make a steak for yourself that's like hanging over the side of your plate. You're just not, right?
Yeah, it struck me cooking your recipes that they are really recipes designed for people who enjoy cooking. You know, you just end up really appreciating the ingredients so much when you cook your way through them and discover new qualities to them, as in the carrots turning into sauce. Yeah. And it was fun, slipping the fish into this beautiful velvety orange sauce.
Oh,
it was great.
I'm so glad you enjoy that one. I love that dish, actually. It's
really
is quite
good.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Cilantro on top. It was really
I like
nice.
To say that I use ordinary ingredients in extraordinary ways. Mm-hmm. So I try not to use, my mother-in-law lives in Michigan, in Lansing, Michigan, and I call her my focus group of one. Like I'll call her like, Marianne, can you get, you know, tamarind paste? You know, if she can't get it, I'm probably not going to put it in that recipe just because I don't want people to have to hunt around so many different stores. And now, luckily, we can get so many. Like, you can buy chia seeds in regular stores. And I mean, it's pretty amazing how the offerings, what's available to us, has changed in the past decades.
Oh, so true. So true. It's incredible. We can get, you know, smoked paprika just in regular
isn't
grocery
that
amazing? Store.
Smoked paprika is heavenly.
You know, and it is heavenly. Now, about the developing of your recipes, you know, unlike so many people out there, you know, in our digital era, you really test your recipes. And what
imagine that.
Yeah, and it's
what
not
a concept.
All that common. Retest them at sunset, and you undergo, you know, they undergo quite a rigorous process. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your team and how the recipe, what its life is, how that works.
So when I'm doing a book,
I think so. Yes, for a book or yeah, I guess in this case, a book. Since
yeah,
we're
so
here.
It's different. So I'm doing the food column also for the Washington Post, and then a lot of that's more seasonal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's what's, you know, happening now. Cause I'm just doing those recipes a month in advance. With a book like this, I'm doing 150 recipes on a particular theme. And so I pull together a team to help me because to really get the kind of quality you want, my personal capacity is about 5 recipes a week to test them and maybe retest them several times. Mm-hmm. I've probably tested the most I've tested something is like 7 times. And only sometimes, once or twice in my whole career, have like really scrapped a concept completely. Mm. But with the book, I start to like just brainstorm what are things that are easy to freeze, for example, and just kind of build out like concepts. And then say something's going to be a chicken, let's do stew, right? That's a no-brainer. Or, you know, I'm going to go back because in the book, there's lots of stews and chilies and things, which is okay. You think about that as freezing. But also, I really try to think a little bit differently about what's great to freeze. And I do these meals in foil packets that literally you can prepare. You don't even cook them. You just kind of throw the stuff in the foil packet. One is a Cajun shrimp with vegetables. And it's like corn and peppers and zucchini. And you just chop it up and put it in there with a little bit of, I think, a little white wine. And then you put them in the freezer just like that. And then you pull them out and go straight from the freezer to the oven. So, and then they're ready in 20 minutes or 25 minutes, which I love. You serve it over rice or quinoa or something. But so I'll think about, okay, foil packets are great. Maybe I'll do a couple of things with that. And I'll kind of start there and then just sort of brainstorming like, what's interesting, what's flavorful, what's colorful, what's vegetable driven and easy to get and easy to make and just sort of, I don't know, it's a really fun process. And I work with a little kitchen team when I'm doing a big project, like a book. Mostly I develop my recipes just on my own. But if I'm doing a huge project, I really need to get some other professionals involved. So it's really fun to play off of each other and have a group of creative people to work with. Mm-hmm. And then we test, I'll test them. And I like that. I love that part. I mean, to me, when I'm like sauteing an onion, it's like, this is fun. Much more fun than answering emails, you know? Love that.
Absolutely.
And then I must say, there's a whole other part to it that people don't normally think about, and that's the writing of the recipe. And that takes a tremendous amount of time, as you know,
yes,
to like really put into words what is happening and what to look for. And I take a lot of care to try to make it as no-brainer mm-hmm. as possible. And then for this book, I also tested, which I was like, what was I thinking in the middle of the process? Because I also gave you explicit directions for how to store it and how long, and then how to thaw it if it needed to be thawed, or how to reheat it, uncovered or covered, because these are questions that I feel like I was always wondering for myself. You know, you get a recipe, they say you can make it ahead, and then you're like, okay, now what do I do? What's really the best practice of how is this really going to come out best? So I wound up, after I tested the recipes for this book, I wound up testing them, thawing and reheating in several different ways. And sometimes I had to remake something, even though, you know, mm-hmm. the recipe was perfect, I thought, as it was. I had to retest it just to test the thaw. So, but I feel happy that I did that in the end, because I do feel like it's a really added value.
Absolutely. Well, and speaking of all the thawing and the freezing and the thawing, you have included a whole section called the 411 on storing, thawing, and reheating, which some people think they know already. And I thought it was a
great
and helpful.
Is this the time where we quiz the audience?
Yes, I am curious to let you know. Don't panic. What are the elements of this chapter that might be a surprise to people, things that they didn't know that you may
have
observed?
Okay, well, you had said one that it was a surprise to you, and that was that you should, ideally, you want to chill something before you put it in the freezer, and then it will be less likely to form those ice crystals if it goes into the freezer cold. And then ideally, if you have like a super fast freeze function, you should freeze it as quickly as possible. But to bring it to a cold temperature before you put it in the freezer will help uncovered, chill it.
I'm doing that from now on. That was a great tip.
And then the other one is that you can put something hot into the refrigerator. People are always like, do I have to leave it out for an hour? No. As long as your refrigerator was made like after 1975, which I'm guessing, yes. And I just came up with that year off the top of my head. I don't know if that's officially when, but.
Yeah, it's a really good section. And I also, after spending some time with this book, I wondered about how you grew up and the kind of food influences that you had in your life. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about being a child in your household in Queens,
yes,
in New York, where you grew up. And then we'll talk a little bit about how you became you after that, how your career,
yikes,
how you figured it all out.
So, so I love to say this quote because it really pins me down. My mother says that me becoming a nutritionist is like a pyromaniac becoming a firefighter. It's completely me. I always loved food. From as long as I can remember, as long as my mother can remember, I like came out, you know, wanting a roast chicken kind of thing. So I was always, you know, sought that out. And my family, we were all food lovers. And growing up in Queens, it's really one of the most cultural diverse places in the country, maybe the world. And it was terrific. So my parents were both civil servants. My dad was a police officer, actually, New York City police officer. My mom, a teacher. And so we didn't have much discretionary income, but so we'd go out to dinner to like these little family-owned Dominican places in Queens or Chinatown in New York, and the whole family could eat for like $12. And we just had these great food experiences, and just, I always loved it. And I remember my first, like, we'd go to these, like, Greek church festivals, and I had my first spinach pie. I'll never forget. I feel like I'm always trying to get back to that moment when I bit into that phyllo dough for the first time, not really knowing what it was. Oh my gosh, it was ambrosial. So I have a really good spinach pie in this book, by the way.
Oh, it looks
inspired
fantastic.
Inspired by that.
I haven't tried that yet.
Oh, it's a mixed greens pie, actually. It has like kale and collards in it too, and spinach. But so I grew up being very passionate about food and actually being an overweight child and not and really feeling bad about myself, honestly. Really not. I remember when I was a kid, I had a picture dictionary and there was a picture of an elephant and I wrote Ellie over it. Isn't that so sad?
That is sad.
I think about that little girl, like, it's okay.
Well, for how many years were you chubby?
So I know, we have these terrible words. So I think when I was about 12 or 13, I started really eating healthfully and literally just stopped snacking on a million things. And my mom really helped me and just ate a lot of vegetables and started being more active. It was quite simple at that age. You know, I was growing tall and so it really transformed very quickly in the course of a year by just doing those things. And yes. Then, honestly, I went in the other direction.
Yes. So the very amazing thing is that you went from being an overweight child to becoming a model. Yeah. You know, within a short span of a few years, probably, because you were probably quite young when you started your modeling career.
So I was like 17 or 18. Mm-hmm. It was really, I needed a job after my freshman year of college. And so I had some friends in the fashion business that said, oh, you should try this. And I literally pounded the pavement. You know, living in New York, it helped that I was there already, and it was not easy. It wasn't like someone swept me up, but I almost gave up. I had like $300 that I had to spend before I had to get a job. And I remember I budgeted out, like I could do it for 1 month if I had spent $10 a day, including transportation, lunch, everything, running around on castings. And I finally got a job just when I was about to give up. And then I got an offer to go to Tokyo.
Wow.
And so I took a year off of school and spent time in Japan and then went to Milan and did all the whole circuit. But then I went back to school. But I wound up paying for my whole college and master's and really subsidizing this for quite a while.
How
it wound up being like this 15-year career, which I'm very grateful for.
Well, and you've also said that, you know, that there are surprising similarities in the mindset between being overweight and being too skinny, which many models are.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could talk about how they're similar.
Yeah, and I also went on to, I was in private practice for many years, and I wound up working with a lot of models. So agents would send them to me, so I really understood the business and the pressures. And also a lot of times people who I worked with would often swing from overweight to underweight. And really all this, I mean, there's many factors involved, but one thing that I saw was that it's really about not knowing how to take care of yourself. And both of them can be really symptoms of the same problem, and that is not knowing how to nourish yourself appropriately and set appropriate limits. And that's about finding balance and nourishing yourself. And it has to come from a place of loving yourself. And it's not easy. You know, I feel like I experienced that self-hatred as a child, and then going to the other extreme of being too skinny and maybe even having some disordered eating behaviors that when I look back on were there. But I found the balance. And I think it is often two sides of the same coin. And it's as having a 13-year-old daughter, I feel like I see the pressures on her. And just hope that I can help guide her away from that. But it's pervasive in our culture.
It sure is. Well, your books definitely help get people into the kitchen.
I can only hope.
And then I wondered what inspired you to become a nutritionist, because you started out studying medicine. Isn't that
right? So I majored in nutrition because it was, I was pre-med.
You were pre-med it. Yeah.
And I majored in nutrition because it fulfilled all the pre-med requirements, and I loved food, so I thought, oh, that makes perfect sense. But then when I started learning about the depth and breadth of the field of nutrition, I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. And it's just a great field. It's fascinating. It never stops being interesting. It's become more and more interesting over the years, I think. And there's so many layers to it. It's psychology, it's sociology, it's biology, it's agriculture, it's politics, it's everything.
It does touch everything. Food extends into all dimensions of life, and certainly nutrition as well. How do you see nutrition as having changed since you were studying it for the first time? I mean, it's been such a changing landscape in that way.
We know about the microbiome.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's incredible to me. Mm-hmm. So groundbreaking. But when I was in school, and I hate to kind of talk about this because it makes me feel a little bit old, but I will anyway. When I was in school, it was really the time when fat made you fat. And that was like the prevailing wisdom of the time. And I do see how, you know, marketing really took that to like, oh, eat as much sugar as you want and you won't get fat. I don't think experts were ever saying that. But it was this notion that fat made you fat. We didn't really understand the role of healthy fats and so on. And I feel like it's very important. People say, oh, nutritionists always change their mind. Nutrition experts, they never know what to believe. But I think it's so important that we do have the ability to change our mind, because if you don't change your mind, then you're stuck in a dogma. And there's nothing that's counter science, anti-science, more than being stuck in a dogma. So I think it's about having an open mind, not turning on a dime, but watching the evolution of the science and being able to say, wow, even though I built my entire career on not, and my found wrote my book on this, maybe that's not right. And I think we get into danger when people start to fall, when scientists start to fall into dogmas because they have too much invested in their perspective. That's not science.
Well, and speaking of perspective, and I also wanted to say, we'll address your questions toward the end of the program, and I'll read your questions all in one go with Ellie. Speaking of the perspective on nutrition, I wondered if we could step back and look at that broader picture for a moment too, and ponder all the diets that have sprung up in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. You know, there's so many choices for how to eat, and some people see it as liberating, other people see it as overwhelming, some think it's just funny. But I wanted to ask you about a few of the ones that we all know, and particularly gluten-free as a necessary choice for disease control in many cases, but also increasingly as a way of life. You know, people are saying gluten-free in the same breath as organic and local, and what is your take on that?
So it's very multi-layered. Mm-hmm. So I have, in my very own family, my stepbrother, he is celiac, and his kids are gluten, and his wife and daughter are gluten sensitive. So in my own little family, we have this spectrum. When I was in school, that's another thing that really changed. I was taught that, oh, it's extraordinarily rare. 125,000 people have celiac. What we learned is that really we were just diagnosing the tip of the iceberg, diagnosing by a few symptoms when there are many more symptoms and not all of them reflect that tip of the iceberg symptom that we were just judging everything on. So many, many more people have celiac than we thought 20 years ago. And also there is apparently an increased incidence in celiac, in true celiac. If you have celiac, you cannot have any gluten, not a trace of it. Not a little bit will make you sick. If something is on a cutting board and you cut bread on that and then you cut something else and serve that to someone with celiac, they can feel sick that night. And ultimately, it's really the only treatment absolute gluten avoidance. And so that is to be taken very seriously. And it's much more prevalent than we had thought. The other thing is that's now recognized is gluten sensitivity, where people get sick if they eat too much gluten, so they can handle some. And so, you know, this is a sort of a new thing that's been recognized. And it's different for every person. And so I think these things need to be very respected. What I have a problem with is gluten-free as fad, as Hollywood fabulousness, you know, to eat it to be Hollywood skinny. First of all, it doesn't work that way. Most of the gluten-free products out there are actually less healthy for you than the regular one. Gluten is not unhealthy inherently. It's a wheat protein in wheat, mm-hmm. and it gives the structure to bread and stuff. So it's not unhealthy. It actually is a protein. So it's things that are made with wheat will have generally a higher protein content than something, let's say whole wheat, especially, you know, more fiber and so on. In order to replicate that effect in a gluten-free product, a gluten-free bread, you usually have to add a lot of starch or gums, which are less healthy for you. So if you're going to be swapping products like that, you're not going to be doing any favors to yourself. And the other thing is, many people, I think the issue is that they were just eating far too much bread. And then maybe they just need to eat less bread. Like, it's sort of simple. And so I think this is their way of eating less bread. They have to go to these extremes. And so finding a better balance in their diet by eating more vegetables, as an aside or relevant information, is that all vegetables, meats, fish are inherently dairy-free. I'm dairy-free. And dairy is inherently gluten-free. Mm-hmm. So you're going to, if you've been eating a ton of bread and gluten-y products, now you're rebalancing. Of course you feel better. You're getting some minerals, you're getting some fiber, you're getting some nutrients. But it's not really, it's almost a side effect. But what really upsets me, and I think this is important to be aware of, so people, you know, now more and more chefs are aware and restaurants are really making an effort to be gluten-free. But I think what's very frustrating from the chef perspective, because I was talking to some chefs about this, that they will take it so seriously as if someone has celiac, someone will say, I can't have any gluten. They'll be busy in the back there. They will wash the pan. They will wash the knife. They will wash the station. They'll clean off the cutting board, and they'll make this meal for this person who says they're gluten-free, and then the person orders cake for dessert. And it's very frustrating. So I think we could be clear and say somehow we need to communicate a little bit better. I think it'll make it easier for everyone.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the new dietary guidelines for Americans were released just a few weeks ago, and it's caused a bit of a conversation, shall we say, among nutritionists. Some people are saying, you know, it could have gone further in one direction or another, you know, how come the beef industry escaped without a scratch, meaning red meat is not limited in any way, and I wondered what your thoughts were on the guidelines, if you overall agree with it, if there are any parts of it that you wish had been stronger or different in some way.
So I'm happy about the statement on sugars. I'm happy that it addresses overall eating patterns as opposed to really any particular diet. I'm glad that the restriction for cholesterol has been removed, but being mindful still of saturated fat, which will help temper. You know, I had this, I do this live chat through the Washington Post every other week. If anyone wants to participate, I really am sitting there for an hour answering questions. And somebody said, I have high cholesterol. My doctor said I should stop eating eggs, so many eggs. But I think that's, you know, the new wisdom is that you can eat as many eggs as you want. And so somehow this message of like, cholesterol isn't as, you know, important to limit gets blown up into eating 10 eggs a day. I don't know how this happens. So this man literally thought that it was like, oh, I can eat as many as I want. Meanwhile, two eggs have as much saturated fat as a small steak. So I think if you're just looking at saturated fat, you're going to naturally be limiting. But I think eggs are great, and I'm a fan, but you shouldn't have 10. So I think somehow we get into the extremes. But to answer your question, I think this is super important. So I'm a member of something called the True Health Initiative, and it was really terrific. It was a big conference of all of these nutritional experts, everyone from Walter Willett from Harvard to David Ludwig to Dean Ornish to the founder, essentially, of the Paleo, the science behind the paleo diet, everyone getting together. And there was this conference called Finding Common Ground. And the truth is that these scientists all agree, right, on some basic principles that this is essentially good advice. And one of the things that came up in that conference was a discussion about the guidelines. And here's the issue. everyone, all of this, this is real consensus that everyone in that room felt, believed, and you could read the consensus statement actually on Finding Common Ground, True Health Initiative. I forget, I don't know the exact website, but that's the name of it. But it's the consensus statement, and believe that the scientific process behind the guidelines, they wholeheartedly supported. So the scientists that made up the advisory commission that advised what the, that made the recommendations for the guidelines were completely supported, even with these people who are always arguing in the media, right? Then this recommendation goes into the political machine. And that's, why is this political? Why do we now say, oh, let's just check with all the political people to make sure the dietary guidelines are fine? Like, why is that a political process? It's not a political recommendation. It's a health recommendation. Mm-hmm. And so this is the problem I have. And so, and I think that's the issue that all of these people on the in the True Health Initiative and who participated in this uncommon ground, in this common ground statement sort of feel, mm-hmm. that this shouldn't really, it's a problem that we're mixing health expertise and then running it through a political sieve, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, it's collision of two sometimes opposing forces, yeah. It seems. Well, I'd like to, at this point, remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Margot True, the food editor of Sunset Magazine and your moderator for tonight's program. And our guest tonight is the New York Times bestselling and award-winning author Ellie Krieger. And we're discussing her latest cookbook, You Have It Made, Delicious, Healthy, Do-Ahead Meals, as well as many other fascinating topics in nutrition and her opinion of them. So we'll continue. I wanted to mention, too, all of your work in the public arena. And I wondered if you could take us back to the moment when Michelle Obama asked you to be part of Let's Move and what it was that you did at the White House.
Well, primarily it was a big scramble because they said, oh, we'd love you to come to the White House to do an initiative, a wellness initiative for this program. And could you do this in 48 hours and give us your list? And all like, okay, cancel that, do this, get the train ticket. Rah. It was crazy. Wow. But it was an incredible experience. And to be on the White House lawn, I think, I don't know if you remember, it was several years ago, and it was Michelle Obama was hula hooping. That's what kind of got in the press the most. But it was a whole program on the lawn for kids, and I did this whole setup of Eat the Rainbow, and all the kids tasted the rainbow. But it was where she there announced the Let's Move program and the Healthier U.S. Schools Initiative, mm-hmm. In conjunction with the USDA. And actually, mm-hmm. I was so inspired by her speech that day that I said, why am I not doing this in my daughter's school? And I went and kind of dug my heels in and said, I'm going to do this in my daughter's school, and formed the wellness committee in her public school. And we became the first New York and only New York City school to meet the U.S. Healthier Schools Challenge.
Wow.
So that was a lot of work. And it was really great because I got the experience of understanding this activism from a leadership level through the press and the White House and doing all this. But then what it's like to go and make tastes of cauliflower for 700 kids, and where are we going to get the cauliflower, and how are we going to get the parents to volunteer, and how are we going to make this happen? And that's a whole other ball of wax. Mm-hmm. And I really believe you can't be up here saying, do this, this is really important, if you're not willing to be down here cutting cauliflower. And mm-hmm. And I feel like that was an amazing experience on both levels, to be part of the Let's Move program on that level and promoting it, and also to be working in my daughter's school, feeding kids cauliflower who had never tried roasted cauliflower before. And we're like sniffing it and then tasting it and like, oh, see their face change. You know, it's remarkable.
That's so great. Well, and I also wanted to mention that you, although your show for the Food Network ended a few years ago, you have a brand new show for public television coming up this May. And it's called Ellie's Real Good Food. Have I got it right?
Yes.
Ellie's Real Good Food. So look for it in May.
Yes, I'm so excited. I've been working really hard to make it happen. And it's just, we just finished shooting most of the studio episodes, and it just feels fresh and exciting. And there's such good food. And in each episode, each episode hits the sweet spot where delicious and healthy meet, absolutely, and helps people get there. And each episode sort of addresses a real person's issue that everyone could relate to. Like they're too busy, they are running out the door and just eating bars for breakfast, and they're just desperate for some solutions. So that whole show is going to be about breakfast and helping that person find solutions. I have one episode that's a couple. One is a meat lover, and the wife is a vegetarian, and literally they're making two separate meals every night. So how can they come together at the table and make one meal that they can both kind of customize a little bit, but both enjoy together? So things like that. And I'm really enjoying shooting it, and I'm excited. And I think public television is a great home for me. So I'm thrilled about that.
That's exciting. We'll tune in. Well, you have a wealth of questions that come up from the audience. Okay.
I hope I have answers.
Cannot
make guarantees.
What is your feeling about what has come to be artistically decorated small portions that have resulted in people taking pictures throughout every course throughout the meal?
I'm guilty. But I try to be very subtle about it. I think people are so wrapped up. It's funny, so many people are seeing the world from their phone now instead of actually experiencing it. So I am very, very, very strong advocate of mindfulness and being at the table and putting the phone away. And actually in my home, that's a huge thing. It's like taboo to have anything electronic on. But I do allow for some, that sort of starts after I take the picture of the food. But also, I think it's very important not to use a flash. It's very disturbing to people, and it never comes out good either. So just if you just quietly do it, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to stand on the chair and be like this with your flash bulb. I mean, I was sitting next to someone at a restaurant who was literally flash, 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 up like, oh, I'm. Don't mind me. I do this professionally. I have a blog. I'm like, all right.
It's still
annoying. It was so rude. I was like this. So I think just being respectful of others and then doing your thing quietly and then being mindful of your meal and actually enjoying it is probably a good way to go.
Thank you. Then what is your favorite make-ahead meal and your favorite non-make-ahead meal?
I don't have a favorite. I mean, I make different stuff all the time. Oh, goodness me. I couldn't pick.
You just have a constellation of choices.
Yeah, and that's what I love about food. I love the variety. So I want something different every time. I think if I were to have like a go-to sort of thing, I really love one-pot meals. So I love chilies and soups and stews. And one of my favorite, I guess I'll say one favorite thing that I love to make for company is like a bouillabaisse or fish stew, because you make the base ahead of time. And then just before the company, you know, before you're ready to serve, 5 minutes before, you just put the fish in. Then you serve it in a big bowl with a nice crusty piece of bread. And it just looks so special and fancy, but it literally takes no more effort than making.
And you froze the base.
And you can freeze the base, or you can leave it in the refrigerator for a couple of days, 3-4 days. So you can totally make it ahead and be like, you know, all cool and hostess with the mostest.
What's keeping the reluctant cook out of the kitchen? How can we bring him or her into the kitchen?
I think a lot of people don't have cooking skills. Like they really don't even know what, like don't know how to cook an onion. They don't know how to cut properly. I think knife skills is one of, you know, if you can quickly cut an onion, it's not such a laborious process cooking. You can, you know, get some efficiency at it. I think a couple things. So a lack of like some basic skills that we're just not learning. We just haven't passed down. And also the sense of you have to be perfect. Like, it really doesn't have to be. I think in one way, the Food Network and TV shows have really inspired people to be more interested in trying different foods. And I think people are more open-minded to different foods than ever before. And I think that's terrific. On the other hand, in some ways, many shows that make it seem like, oh, I have to, you know, crush these veal bones or something to make a sauce for dinner. Like, you don't. You know, you can make a delicious, just broil a piece of fish with salt, pepper, and lemon juice, and it's going to be delicious. So I think we have also this sense of that we have to be perfect or do something fabulous, when simple food can be absolutely wonderful if you have really good ingredients. And if you make a mistake, it's okay. That's how you learn. I think people are also afraid to mess it up. Mm-hmm. But that's life in general, right? Sometimes we don't try things because we're afraid to do it wrong.
Yeah. And then you just never end up cooking,
right?
And what pleasure it can give. And that kind of is along the same lines as this question. Any advice for a novice cook trying to prep meals in advance? How do I know where to start? Are there pantry suggestions or some ingredients that you have on hand?
Well, I would say sometimes it feels very overwhelming. Like any kind of change can feel overwhelming. So just paring it down. So I would say pick two recipes and just start with that. And you start to develop your repertoire then. But you don't, somehow you don't know where to begin, because it's just like you feel like you have to do something every day, or literally maybe make two recipes or even one recipe a week and just start there, so that you've done that and you can say check done on that, and then you can sort of build from there. I think sometimes we feel like we have to make changes that are so dramatic. If you're never cooking, suddenly you have to cook every day. Literally start with one recipe that's easy for you.
And master
and that. And that looks good to you. Like, make something that inspires you.
That you like to eat.
Yes.
You know? First, it was acai berries. I'm not sure I'm saying that right.
Acai.
First, it was acai berries. Then it was kale. What do you think will be the next food trend?
Oh, I just wrote an article on this, actually. So there were five that I So besides the Nourish column for the Washington Post, I also write a nutrition column, which is not recipe driven, but more like this kind of thing. And so I identified sorghum, which I have tried for the first time American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics conference, and I thought it was so delicious and made this beautiful salad, and it's drought resistant, has all these great qualities, and it's an ancient grain and it's gluten free, so it just seemed seeing more of it. It's really fun. I like to try different things. So I thought sour gum was interesting. Also, kraut, sauerkraut, and fermented foods. I think that's going to continue to be more popular. And I forget what else I put on that list. I put five things on that list, but those are two that come to mind. Yeah.
Well, and then how about meat? Thoughts on eating less meat for environmental reasons? How much meat should we be eating?
Yeah. I mean, and it's, see, here's the thing. Humans are really amazingly adaptable. And so if you look around the world, and look at historically and even look at science, there's an amazing spectrum of diets that are healthy. I was in Africa, and I really had this wonderful opportunity to interact with the Maasai people. And they literally live off of their cows. So they drink the cow blood, they let the blood, and they milk the cows, and that's the primary core of their diet. I know I see some like, ugh, faces, but it's true, that's what their core diet is. And so they don't drink much water at all. People say, oh, the Maasai are superhuman, they cannot drink water. Well, most of their diet's fluid from milk and blood, so they don't need as much water. And then they forage for, you know, and this is the traditional diet, they forage for berries and different things, but that's the base of their diet. And then you have everything to like a traditional Okinawa diet, which is very rice-based, to the Mediterranean diet. So it's really remarkable how many different things are appropriate and that we can be adaptable. So I think it's a very individual thing. I don't think you can say one amount of meat is going to be right for everyone. It really depends on what your needs are. And certainly there are very, very healthy vegetarian diets with no meat. So I think that you can't really answer that question you can't answer that question for the entire population. In terms of environmental impact, it seems very clear that, you know, ruminant animals, you know, have a more impact on the environment. So I think eat high quality meat that's raised ethically and slaughtered ethically. Mm-hmm. If you're going to eat meat, and just respect it. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're sometimes very wasteful in our society. We waste something like 40% of the food that we buy. If we wasted mm-hmm. less and respected food more, whether it's even any food, but certainly meat, I think we'd all be better off if we mm-hmm. come from that approach.
Please talk about the Food Channel. What was your audition like? And how is that process different today? What makes a Food Network star?
Ooh. it was really interesting for me because I had another TV show before my Food Network show. It was called Living Better with Ellie. Hmm. Ellie Krieger. I forget if my last name was on there. And it was like a magazine-style show. And so after that, I wrote my first book. And then literally, I got a call on my answering machine from Bob Tushman and his assistant saying, oh, we saw your book and we'd love you to come in. We want to meet you. We want to do a healthier TV show. And so from that process, I met them. And it was really remarkable because the name of my book, my first book was Small Changes, Big Results. Mm-hmm. And literally, Bob Tushman had this little napkin that he had been writing some ideas on. And it sort of said, like, small changes, big results on it. Like, it was really, we were so in sync with our philosophies. So it was a really wonderful match. But it took about a year. We shot a pilot, and then they, you know, aired the pilot with this focus group. And apparently, there people are in this room with this, their hand on a knob that's like, I like this, I don't like this, the entire time. And there's people in the back graphing this stuff. And so then they'll see why the person didn't like it. It might be they didn't like oatmeal. It might be, oh, that Ellie, she's so boring, whatever. But I guess more people, it went, you know, obviously it went. So it was about a year from the time I met them to the time we started shooting. And it was amazing. It was amazing.
Gosh.
But it is an incredible process. And I really don't know. If people sometimes say to me, other dietitians say, how do you get on TV? I'm like, I have no idea. I really don't. I think you just keep putting good work out there and honing in on your message. And also it's so neat because I think what has changed is that now from when I started, you know, I did an internship at CNN, I did an internship at CBS, so I was really trying to understand the media business, and it was something I really wanted to combine my love of food and science with my on-camera, you know, passion for being on camera and ability that I had learned in all my years modeling and doing TV commercials and stuff. And so I was really wanting to do this exact thing that I'm doing. So I'm so thrilled every day. But I did an internship at CNN, internship at CBS. At that time, there was no, you know, YouTube and blogging. I mean, you really had to go through the filter of an editor or a producer. And now it's so democratic. Like, nothing's easy, right? Nothing valuable is really easy in the end. But at least it's more democratized, where you can really put it out there and you can hone your skill in a forum that, you know, start shooting video. Just do it. Put it up there. Mm. You really don't have anything to lose and you just get better.
We have time for one last question, which is, what advice do you like to give to people who are really worried about their weight? You know, they just don't think they can do it. They feel like they just have to be, they have to follow everything very much to the letter in order to make it successful, and, you know, diet plans that are very strict. And
yeah. I always think, you know, inside you, we all have this internal wisdom, and we ignore it. And we ignore it. Well, this may be too complex an answer, but I'm going to do it. Go for it. We're all born with an innate mechanism that tells us when to stop, that we're hungry and we're satisfied. You can't force feed a baby. Everyone who's every healthy person. And then somewhere around 5, we start to respond, and that's our internal cues. We just listen to them. I'm hungry, I've had enough. When we start to be about 5 years old, we start to respond to external cues. You're such a good eater. What is that? You're so good at surviving. Like, why do we say that? You're a good eater. Why is someone a good eater? And so we start to respond to, oh, you're going to get this reward. You're going to get a lollipop. You're going to get an ice cream cone. Now food is a reward. And we start to, then we get older, maybe we start to follow this piece of paper that says, oh no, you're only supposed to have one piece of toast and a black coffee and a half a grapefruit. And now we're following a piece of paper, even though we're maybe hungry because we ran yesterday. And so now we're still not listening to ourselves. And suddenly we become deaf to our own bodies. And I think what's so important, and not suddenly, it's creeped up on us from the age of 4 or 5. And I think to get back to that a little bit and to trust that a little bit, and also think about why you're eating. You know, I think some people are worried about food, but I have in my book, Small Changes, Big Results, the first book, this hunger scale. So it's 1 is like very famished, and 10 is completely stuffed, like Thanksgiving full, and 5 is a point of balance. And so really, where are you on there? Like right now, I'm at a 5 personally. Like I kind of can tell where I am. So even thinking about that and trusting that a little and knowing that you don't have to eat when you're at a 4, which may be your first little pings of hunger. I think sometimes we're like, oh, can't get hungry. You got to have a snack. Got to have a snack. And if you go to Europe and stuff, people are not snacking every 2 seconds. And you go back to my daughter, you know, you go to these classes, like she's in a music class for 45 minutes and they give out crackers. Like, really? We need a cracker because we danced for 10 minutes? Like, oh. So I feel like we're sort of training ourselves for this. So maybe start, eat something when you're maybe at a 3. Like, let yourself be a little bit hungry and then honor that and eat something and really stop eating when you're like at a 5 or at a 6 or a 7. Most of us eat really fast and not mindfully. And we get way past that 7, 8, 9 regularly.
11.
Yeah. So I would address it from that, like kind of intuitive and having a little trust and trust for yourself.
Well, as it turns out, we have room for time for a couple more questions. So I'm going to ask this one, organic versus non-organic. What vegetables are best to buy organic?
So I think organic, I really believe in organic food production. But I also, it's interesting because sometimes you're looking, this is to me the conundrum. You're at the market and you're looking at, so I'm in New York, right? I'm looking at organic apples from Washington and non-organic apples from the farm 20 miles away. Now what do I do? So my sort of thing is local first, ideally local organic. And then for many reasons, and oftentimes if you're at a farmer's market, they're doing really integrated pest management, more ethical spraying, but they're not fully organic, or maybe they can't even afford the organic seal because that whole process is expensive. So you can really talk to the farmer, and then you're supporting like a local business, small business essentially, and you're really enriching things on a lot of levels. Plus you're getting something really fresh picked, which is going to taste better and have more nutrition. So I go with local first, ideally local organic, then local not organic, then organic, then conventional. And I think it's really important to know that I think one of the things like, oh, I'm not going to eat those blueberries because they're not organic. That's a mistake. You're losing out. That any vegetable or fruit, the benefit of eating it far outweighs any potential residual pesticides, which you can wash off. So that comes to the question of what to not, that maybe you don't have to buy organic if you're just really looking at pesticide residues and not necessarily the whole environmental aspect of it. But if you're just looking at pesticide residues, anything you peel, so a banana, an avocado, an orange, you're getting really rid of that.
Well, then our final question, a provocative one. Can fast food be healthy?
Yeah, why not? Apples are fast, right? So I do mean like...
The drive-through kind of fast
like that.
Food.
And I think there's a lot of... There is a lot of potential. There's so much new innovation happening in that field right now with like Sweetgreen. I don't know. Do you guys have that here? Sweetgreen is really nice. They have like grain bowls and it's fast. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of innovation. A lot of really great chefs are starting to do fast casual in really great quality. I think one of the problems that how do you define healthy? And just because something doesn't have a lot of calories doesn't mean it's healthy. So a lot of times fast food places will say, oh, this chicken salad only has this many calories and this much fat. But if you look at it, it's completely rubberized, processed, low quality food, and that's not healthy. So healthy, again, coming back to kind of the beginning, is not necessarily defined by the numbers involved. But looking at the quality of the food. And I think there's a lot of great potential. Why not? Why couldn't it be? Let's make it, you know, let's support that and make it happen. I don't see why not. And I'm seeing a lot of hope for that in terms of the new restaurants and stuff.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Ellie. Thank you to you and your new cookbook, You Have It Made, Delicious, Healthy, Do-Ahead Meals. And thank you for being here with us tonight. We also thank our audiences here with us in studio, as well as on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Margot True, and also, I wanted to thank the Bernard Osher Foundation for underwriting this program as a part of the club's Food Lit series. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.